Is George recovered alcoholic with no reservation? Not even lurking notion. I'm sober today by the grace of God and program of Alcoholics Anonymous and my footwork. I'd like to welcome the newcomers. Welcome to the kindergarten of the universe. This is it. What I learn here, I never learn it out there. My childhood was very awesome until the lady killed my dad, drunk driver. And after that, it was on. I drink alcoholically from the get-go. My dad used to smoke opium, used to drink, and my mom used to make a homemade wine. You go figure what happened to me. But I don't blame my alcoholism to my parents. I don't hold the resentment against that lady that killed my father. I used to escape from kindergarten. I mean, I didn't like school. And something was wrong from beginning. I have three sisters and none of them alcoholic, thanks God. Same mother and same father, same blood as far as I know. But they don't have that ism. I'm Armenian, I was born and raised in Iran, and I came here about over 20 years ago. I couldn't say ABCD. I immediately discovered we have more liquor store than bookstore. I didn't have to know any language to get the booze. After I got my driver license, I got my first DUI. After the first one, immediately I got the second one. After the second one, immediately I got the third one. This is in a short period of time. I mean, I'm not normal person. I'm abnormal. Normal person kick back and says, what's wrong with this picture? My attorney suggested if I go to Alcoholics Anonymous and get the signature sign, it's going to help on my case, which it did at the time. I had a nice binder. I never folded my paper like that. Secretary's name, date of birth, you know, social security, I'm just kidding. I mean, not the places, you know, secretary's name and everything. My attorney was very impressed, and judge too. They slapped me in my hand and they let me go. I came here, I bought the big book, I bought the 12.12 and free literature. I didn't ask for help. Guess what? I got drunk again. This was 86, 87. I had no program. I tried to do it all by myself. And it's too hard. Without help, it is too much for us. September 4, 1996, I got up from work. I say, I'm going to go have two Budweiser and two kamikaze. And that's it. I'm going to go home early tonight. And God knows how many I had that night. After three bars and drinking with the panhandlers in downtown San Jose, I went to liquor store, I bought some booze and went to somebody's house and I got in an argument and I left the place, urinated behind a tree, and I got arrested. I mean, when I drink, I get the stupid and I do stupid things. Then I have to pay the consequences. Not every time I drink I got the stupid, but most of the time I was in a trouble, alcohol was related. See, I have a tendency to forget humiliation of a week or even month ago, just like that. I came up with blackout that night in the drunk tank, and I was crying. I said, God, please help me. I was going to go home early tonight. What happened? Just like in the book, more about alcoholism, pounded on a bar stool. How I got here, you know. The guy handed me the meeting guide. He says, there is a place I think they can help you. Now, the help is here. How bad I want it. You don't know how bad I wanted it. They said, this program is for people who want it, not need it. When I came in, I wanted it so bad. But today, I need it. Just like a water, just like a food, just like breathing. Without Alcoholics Anonymous, I have no life. I'm a low life. Alcoholics Anonymous gave me my life back, my identity back, my dignity back. I always work. I support my habit. If I can't support my habit, I shouldn't have a habit. I can't panhandle for my addictions. And by the way, my addiction is more than my 10 finger, 10 toes and one nose and many other places. But unless I accept my alcoholism, I can't stay sober. And if I have an alcoholic mind, the time and the place would come, I would drink again. I don't have an alcoholic mind. That time, that night in that room, something happened to me I can't explain. Just like Bill W.'s story. He calls the doctor, he says, "Doctor, something happened, I don't understand." He says, "You better hang on to it, it's better what you had." He didn't have nothing, he was hopeless, just like me. So day after, I was still in the fog, I came over here, and I abandoned myself to program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I dive in the book from head to toe. There are people sitting in this room, they know me. They see me at meetings, big book study meeting, 12 by 12 study. I get in this program what I put in it. If I don't put nothing in, I get nothing. I can go to 1,000 meetings a day. If there is no action, there is no reaction. Step 1, 2, and 3 is admission and decision. After that comes the action. I got 2 more minutes. There is a guy in a more about alcoholism on page 40 or 41. He goes to Washington on business. The business went very well, and no cloud in the horizon. He decides to have a couple of drinks. And then he goes for a walk, and he comes back. He decides to have a highball. And many more. And instead of his wife at the landing zone, friendly taxi cab driver escorted him for a week or so. And then they find him in the back alley, his pockets inside out. And he wonder how he got there. He says, "I now remember what my alcoholic friends had told me, how they prophesied that if I have an alcoholic mind, the time and place would come, I would drink again." See, he didn't remember that when he picked up that first drink. He remembered afterward. I don't have an alcoholic mind. On top of page 101, it says, we meet these conditions every day. An alcoholic who cannot meet them still has an alcoholic mind. That tells me someday, somehow, maybe I can drink like a gentleman. I don't remember drinking like a gentleman in my entire life. Or if I'm a woman, I can drink like a gentlewoman. I haven't seen that one either. If you are alcoholic like me, I drink for the effect. I take something because I want to change the way I feel. I drink because I like the effect produced by alcohol. That's why I drink. Alcohol saved me so many times in my life. It was my master, but I have a new master. Bill W. talks about it on page 8 too. In the middle of the page 8, he says, for me, it's very important how dark it is before the dawn. For me, that night in that room, it was very dark and I was very done. And I knew every fiber of my system, I'm not going to drink for the rest of my life, one day at a time. Now, I don't made up that. Bill W. talks about it as Bill sees it, not as George sees it. It's in the book. Whatever I say is my opinion, but what's in the book, it's a fact. I came here, I take suggestions, but not all of them. They say, go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I went to 351 meetings in my 90 days. Remember I said my drug addiction is never enough? I just flipped the coin. I just changed my way of thinking. And tradition 3 says the only requirement for AA membership is an honest desire to stop drinking. But they took that honesty out. It's still in the book, back of the second edition or first edition. But it's still there. They say if somebody comes in, he's not honest, what we do when we are out there, if they can't stay sober, yes they can. Give them a wing to fly so they can get honest with themselves. So I came here, I listened to people, even the people I didn't like. I love everybody. I may don't know you, but I love you. If you are here, you know, I'm glad you are here because you're not out there. It's nice to be here than over there. If you don't know where is over there, you are in the wrong place, sitting in the wrong seat. I've been there, I've done that. I don't need a newcomer to show me it doesn't work out there. There is nothing new for me. And When the student is not ready, he's not ready. The teacher is not going to appear. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. So many times I heard it from people, I love Alcoholics Anonymous, week after they got drunk. I respect Alcoholics Anonymous. Let me rephrase that. I respect Alcoholics Anonymous. I have no respect for people they don't respect Alcoholics Anonymous. This is a serious disease. It kills people. Some people think it's a joke. In and out, in and out. And God bless them. I never give up on anybody because God never give up on me. He's always been there for me. I don't rely on people. People are people. My Heavenly Father never let me down. My God brought me over here, and beautiful people like you keep me over here. I think my time is up. Thank you.
I am an alcoholic, and my name is Carlisle. Glad to be here. I'd like to thank Brian for asking me to come and speak to you all tonight. Grateful to be sober. I look around and wonder what a nice girl like me is doing in a place like this. And what I got to tell you is, I'm not that nice. I recently came to the recollection that I started drinking at a very early age, probably five. And, yes, five. The way that I recollected that was I recalled spending Thanksgiving holidays with my grandparents. And both my parents are alcoholic. And I was introduced to that syrupy green liquid creme de menthe. I thought that was wonderful stuff. What a great combination, pure sugar and alcohol. And I remember them going to the table to eat Thanksgiving dinner and my leaving the table and going back to the place where the liquor was, where the green stuff was, and dumping it while nobody was looking into my glass and drinking more of it. And I didn't have that recollection for a good long time. That wasn't until fairly recently. I never met a drink or a drug that I didn't like. Drugs are a part of my story, and if that bothers you, I'm sorry. I feel like, you know, they're just alcohol in pill or powder form or whatever it is, whatever flavor it is. Never was there enough of what I thought I wanted. So I started drinking in earnest and using drugs at the age of 13. I grew up in a really violent household. I grew up in an atmosphere that looked like from the outside, not in an atmosphere. I grew up in a neighborhood that looked suburban and middle class, white. And on the inside, it was chaos. It was pain. It was fear. It was loneliness, isolation, rage, a lot of rage at my house. What I have to say about that is that there is nothing my parents did or said to make me who I am. And that's what I'm clear about today. What I'm clear about today is that I choose my path. I'm clear about what I do about who I am and how I got here. But it's germane to my story because in what it is that I have to say about where I came from, you may be able to relate. You may be able to say, you know, I felt that. I was like that. That happened to me. And sort of the outcome of that for me has been that I've been able to find Alcoholics Anonymous and get sober and stop the blame game. I came in a big hole looking to get fed. That's what I know. I happen to believe that I was an alcoholic from the day I was born. I'm not interested in debating that with anybody after the meeting. That's what I know for me. Also want to say that I am not an expert on Alcoholics Anonymous. and I'm not an expert on alcoholism. What I have tried to become over the years that I've been sober in AA is an expert on me. So if I say anything that offends you, that's okay. There'll be another meeting tomorrow morning. Or actually, there's one at midnight, isn't there? Come on back. I think we have a wonderful way of life. I think we have an extraordinary opportunity to become the people that God meant us to be. I look around and I see faces that I know have been in and out and in and out of these doors. And I want to say to you right now, if you're sober tonight, if you're drunk tonight, I don't care. You got a seat. You belong. You belong. The only requirement for membership, as George mentioned, is a desire to stop drinking. And they took that word honest out for a good reason. Because none of us, as in my experience, is honest when we get here. I certainly did not have an honest desire to stop drinking. I really tried to be good when I was a kid. I really tried to be obedient. I really tried to go to school like I was supposed to and do those things and be a part of. But I got to tell you, I had a big piece of apart from. And no place to put that. And it pissed me off. I was a street fighting, in your face, no problem, take it to the parking lot kid. And that lasted until I was 27 years old. Actually, sometimes I still have that piece. That's just the truth. It just looks a little different. You know, what I know today is that I have a sordid past and a suburban present. And I didn't look like this when I got here, I'll tell you that. I started drinking heavily at the age of 13, 14 years old. I found drugs, as I said. And, you know, I just remember that it gave me the feeling that I could be something. I could be someone. That I could be valuable. I don't know why I thought that, but it gave me, it was the liquid courage that we all talk about. It gave me an ability to sort of be in the world without the incredible fear and anxiety and rage that I felt all the time. My mother started taking me to psychiatrists when I was about 13 years old. Now, why, you know, does that have anything to do with that's when I started using drugs and drinking? I don't know. All I know is that my mother was a single mom at that time. My parents finally divorced. I experienced, when my parents were together, things like my father holding my mother at the end of a shotgun. We were whisked out of the house by our neighbors in this white bread middle-class neighborhood, and I was taken to my friend's house, and I remember looking across the street into out of her bedroom window into our house and wondering which one of my parents was going to come out alive, if either one of them would. And you know, that's sort of the kind of experience I had as a young kid, walking down the street and looking into other people's houses. And watching people, like, set the table and people sit down and have a meal together. And there was, you know, a mom and a dad and two kids and a dog and all that. And I just remember thinking, God, I want that. Why doesn't my house look like that? I spent a lot of time outside when I was a kid. And many of you can relate to that, I know. 'Cause home was not a safe place. It was not a fun place. Never was there enough of what I thought I wanted, no matter what. When I started seeing psychiatrists, I figured out in a hurry that if you asked for certain drugs, they would prescribe them to you. And that was a really great thing for me. There was a wonderful drug at the time called Quaaludes. And some of you can relate. I said I got so angry and so rageful that I needed to have that drug. and the psychiatrist said, okay, and wrote me a prescription for it. And what I can tell you about that is that I wasn't a big user of this drug for whatever reason, but I love to hand them out to other people. I was very friendly. I was your best buddy. You know, I'd be in the bar at in the bathroom of the bar handing out the Quaaludes. Alcohol was really always my drug of choice, I have to say, because for me, it was, you know, it was quick. It was quick, it was cheap, it was plentiful, and, you know, I just loved it. And, you know, all those other things were a little bit more difficult to get, but, you know, I went on this sort of round of going to the psychiatrist, and, you know, my mother didn't understand why doesn't she want to go to school, you know, why does she stay out all night at 13, 14 years old, running the streets, you know, why did these things happen? And eventually they put me in a hospital. Back then they didn't have so many, like, they didn't have treatment centers like they do today, or did for a while. I guess there are fewer of them now, but and I was put into a psychiatric hospital, and that was a great thing for me because, you know, I was whisked out of the environment that I was in. And I remember even then, at like I had my 15th birthday in a psychiatric hospital. I remember thinking somewhere in the back of my mind, this is good. It's good for me to be confined. It is a good thing for me to be away from the drugs, the people, the alcohol, all of that stuff. You know, like I can maybe think my way through this. You know, I can think my way to right action. And, you know, what I know about that is I wasn't there 2 weeks and I was copping dope outside the hospital and, you know, got some cheap wine or whatever the story was, whatever it was I got. I was a liar. I was a thief. You know, I don't know about cheat, you know. Cheat, doesn't that go along with lying and stealing? I don't know. I guess it's all the same thing for me. I was in a lot of need. I was in a lot of demand all the time. I demanded things. I demanded so much more than life was willing to give me on a regular basis because I wasn't willing to put anything into life. I was not willing to do anything. I wanted it given to me. You know, I am owed this, right? I am owed this. Sure, I should have that. I should have that. You know, I got involved with boys, too. And I want to say this about that. What a lovely diversion. What a lovely, you know, romance, as it were, was a lovely diversion for me. I could use that as a drug or a, you know, mind or mood altering thing. All the women are doing this and all the men are going. You guys know what I'm talking about. So I went to the psychiatric hospital in North Carolina. I grew up in Virginia, by the way. The doctor told my mother that I was depressed and that I just needed to stop sleeping with my boyfriend. I think the horse is already out of the barn. Call me crazy, but I'm thinking probably I'm not going back. You know, I'm not reversing that decision or that behavior. But, you know, if I would just do these things, then everything would be fine. And I don't know how much of their money, my mother's money, they took to tell her that. But, you know, probably not good advice. You know, I went back home to Virginia and from this place in North Carolina. And nothing changed. Nothing changed. You know, as soon as I got home, I started drinking again. As soon as I got home, there was no difference between the person I had been when I left 30 days earlier and the person I was when I got back, except I was on probably some kind of antidepressant of some sort. You know, my life was in disarray. I was 15 years old. I had already missed a ton of school. I was not, you know, I was not a kid who liked to go to school. I hear people tell stories of going through high school and going to college and getting degrees. I got to tell you, I don't get it. I don't know how you did it. Just for me, there is no possible way I could keep it together to do that. I couldn't even get through a day of classes in high school. I mean, that's just me. That's my experience. I didn't like anything about authority. I don't like anything about have to. Okay? I don't know. The word obedient was never in my vocabulary. Have no clue what that is. I had an FU as big as the, you know, state of Maine, state of whatever, Montana, on my forehead. And it was clearly recognizable. Clearly recognizable. There was no mistake that I don't care who you are. I don't care where you came from. If you don't have anything I want, you're out of here. I'm not interested. That was what I presented. And the truth was that I was hurting. I was frightened, and I needed you so badly, and I just couldn't say that. I could not say, I need you. I need you to know who I am. I need you to know what it is to be me. I want you to hear that. I want you to know that I need that. I could never say that. There was no safety in that. There was no guarantee that if I put that out there, anybody was going to respond. Because let's face it, I want more than I'm ever entitled to. So if I tell you I need you, Jesus, you better just jump under my skin. I got to have all of you, right? I got to have all of you now, okay? That's the other thing. I don't wait. What is delayed gratification? What is that? I don't get it as a concept. I mean, I hear today, and I'm 48 years old. Today I hear people say, well, you know, that's in my goals and my career plan. And I'm thinking, what is that? I still don't get it. Okay, I'm just telling you, for me. I know it's a good thing to do. I don't know about it. Okay, never done it. I don't balance a bank statement. I'm just telling you the truth. Some things have not changed. I want more of everything than I'm entitled to. So, you know, I made some kind of half-hearted attempt at going back to high school. And what I really became was one of the most popular girls in the parking lot. You know, I always had, you know, the stuff, whatever it was. I always had the plan. I always knew who had the wheels, if wheels were needed. I always knew, you know what I mean? I mean, I always had stolen enough money from my mother. You know, I had the plan. I mean, I did like parking lot 101 for all of high school. It was what I did. And I really ridiculed the cheerleaders, by the way. So my apologies to any cheerleaders in the audience. I hated them. I wanted to break their ankles. You know what I mean? There was some sweetness or goodness about them that I absolutely detested. And what I really loved was to get them out in the parking lot and get them loaded. Right? Because how sick is it when somebody that's not one of us, like, gets really pounded? I mean, it's like, you know, what a blast. And then let them stagger back to school, you know. It was great. And the truth is, I would have given my eye teeth to be one of those gals. I'd have given anything. That's the truth. The truth is, I'd have given anything to have showed up at my classes all day, to have done my homework, to have been somebody who was reliable. But I had gone way past that point from a long time before. A long time before. You know, it's that thing of, you know, you get that far down the path. And for us, there's no turning around. There's no making it change. There's no making amends, right? There's no doing that. You know, I didn't have any intention of doing that. I just wanted it handed to me. Clean slate, clean slate, clean slate. I'll start again. I want to do it again. Can I, you know, redo? And that wasn't going to happen. So I decided to be as much of a badass as I could possibly be in this little blonde white girl body. You know what I'm saying? I was going to be as much trouble as I could possibly be. Because I wasn't going to get noticed for being good or right. So I would love to be noticed for being the worst. And I got that. I got that. I am also, you know, I was always one of those people who, you know, whenever anybody did anything wrong, I got caught. I always got caught. And I tell all my kids, you know, you don't have a snowball's chance in hell. Because many of, well, I have four. And there's at least three of them who always get caught. And, you know, if you're a person that gets caught, it's just your life. You know, it's the way it goes. It's just the way it goes. So the high school thing didn't work out too well, and they kept popping me in and out of this little psychiatric hospital where I found that if you misbehaved well enough, they would shoot you up with some delicious drug. And what I know about that is that I couldn't get the alcohol into the place. That was a tough one. That place was locked, and they had the key, and they were not letting me out. So, you know, I would have rage tantrums, and then they would, you know, come and strap my arms behind my back and drag me off to the room with the, literally, they have pads, you know, mattresses on the wall, and there's mattresses. Some of you are going, yeah, you get it. I mean, it's supposed to be so you can't hurt yourself. But they would shoot me up with this drug, and that was really, you know, great for me. So I misbehaved as often as possible, trying to make it like every 4 hours. Because I knew they weren't going to give it to me every two. So anyway, I remember my father came to see me when I was in that place. And they actually did let me go out with him. My father was loaded, absolutely loaded when he came to see me. And they let me go out with him in a car. You know, it was the most unbelievable thing. These people have no idea what drugs and alcohol are to alcoholics and addicts. I to this day, I mean, I don't get it. You know, they're supposed to be doctors. You know, it just blows me away. But anyway, I had, you know, such a strange relationship with my father. He was really one of the best drinking buddies I ever had. I developed a wonderful drinking relationship with my father when I hit my teen years. And enjoyed it so much, you know. It was very sick and very abnormal, but I really loved it. It was the only way I got to see my dad. You know, I recollect from the time that I was a little girl, the times that I spent with my dad were at a bar. My dad would take me to his bar of choice, which was called Izzy's. And they had one of those old televisions with the rabbit antennas up in the bar, and they would have baseball on or football on or whatever it was. We're talking, you know, early 1960s. And, you know, he'd set me up on the bar stool, and it was all men. I mean, there were no women in there drinking. And they would slap each other on the back and tell stories and laugh and just be free. There was just a feeling of freedom and camaraderie you know, that I never experienced in my home. I didn't experience it when they took me to their, that my parents were members of a country club, which was part of the show. And when they took me there to go swimming or whatever, there was no, you know, I never sensed that. But man, when I sat up on that bar stool in Izzy's, you know, I was the little girl. And all the men who had wives and children back at home and were probably feeling pretty guilty about that would dote on me, would pay attention to me, would, you know, talk to me and think everything I said was funny and entertaining and all that kind of stuff, you know. So that was where one of the ways that I learned about what alcohol can do for us. You know, it creates a bond for us. It helps to create a camaraderie for us that we don't otherwise have. So having had that experience, that sort of characterized my relationship with my dad. My mom was a stay-at-home drunk who, you know, would be at a, sitting out in the living room on the couch with a bottle of bourbon next to her, and I'd come out in the morning and the cigarette would be burned down between her fingers. And, you know, I mean, she was that kind of drunk. She was a single mom trying to raise two kids, and, it was a hard job. I was put in the last psychiatric hospital when I was 17 years old. They decided to send me to what they called a long-term residential psychiatric hospital. And that was in Baltimore, Maryland. Actually, Towson, Maryland, right outside Baltimore. And I was okay with that because F. Scott Fitzgerald's wife had gone there and other famous people. And, you know, I, of course, thinking that I was special and unique and wonderful, wanted to go to this place because these famous people had gone there. And because, you know, I had a little grandiosity. So I went to this place. And when I graduated from that place, I think because my insurance ran out, I moved out into a halfway house in downtown Baltimore. And, you know, I lived in a really crazy life. One of the stories that I have told frequently is that there was a great bar around the corner from where I lived in this halfway house. It was called Longfellow's. It had a fireplace. It was a great bar. And I would go to this great bar every night and hook up with whatever man had enough money to buy me drinks all night. And I remember one night being on my way to the bar, and I had one of those marijuana cigarettes. And I plopped myself down on the front stoop of one of the brownstone houses that are infamous in downtown Baltimore. And as I sat there in my finery, my suede coat and my high-heeled, probably wedge, whatever, 1970s shoes, and smoking this herb, a man started coming down the street. Now, you got to know, it's Baltimore. It's winter. It's cold, okay? It gets really cold, bone-chilling. You're on the near the water. It's real cold. And this guy comes down in a beanie. And collar turned up, and he walks by me. He gets about, you know, 4 or 5 feet from me as he's going by. Now, here's how we are. I'm terrified to tell you the truth about anything. I'm terrified to let you know who I am. But I'm not terrified to walk the streets of Baltimore, Maryland in the middle of the night. Go figure. So the guy says to me as he passes by, "How much?" And I'm thinking, What'd he say? And I just kind of blow it off, and he comes back. He walked down the block, and he comes back and walks by me again. He goes, "How much?" And all of a sudden, it dawns on me. He thinks I'm a prostitute. Now, I get up, all 5'7" of me, and I say, "You know, you better watch out who you say that to. Like, I'm offended. I'm offended that he thinks I'm a prostitute, okay? Although I'm going to go to the bar and go home with anybody who's got enough money to buy me drinks all night. This is how I think. But I'm offended." Um, I found my way back to Virginia. I got a phone call from my stepfather. No, that's not true. I called him, and my stepfather said, I said, where's Mom? Your mother is in the hospital. She attempted suicide. And I went, hot damn, you know, right away. Like, I got to go. Drama. So exciting. You know, run out onto Charles Street in Baltimore. Pack up my stuff out of the halfway house. Run out. You know, stick out. I did drink a bottle of Southern Comfort, as I recall, on the way out the door. And I had another flatty of bourbon with me. Flatty pint. So I go out to the street and I stick out my thumb. Now I'm going to Baltimore, Washington International Airport. Don't have any clue how to get there. I'm loaded, have no idea how to get there. I've called my boyfriend from back home and said, I have to go and see my mother. She attempted to commit suicide. And he said, fine. And he bought me a ticket, and there's a ticket waiting for me. So off I'm going to Virginia. And I come running into, well, I did have to go to the airport and fall asleep on the bench for a while. You know, kind of like the homeless people we see. I get in the plane, and I'll never forget, there were two pilots, it's like an 8-seat plane or whatever, and the guy gets out a flashlight and is looking at the instrument panel. I remember thinking, oh, I could be in trouble. Anyway, I come walking into this psychiatric hospital where my mother, who has put me in so many psychiatric hospitals, is now in bed because she's attempted suicide. I come flying in with all the drama I can muster, and I'm like, Mom, you know, what happened? And she looks at me like, why are you here? And I, of course, am thinking, you know, I'm here. You should be so grateful. Where is the marching band? Where are the trumpets? There should be cake. You know, I'm here. And she's looking at me like I'm the worst nightmare she ever had. And I can't get that. I loved drama. I ate, breathed, slept drama for so many years. You know why? Because I'm addicted to adrenaline. And drama likes to turn on adrenaline. I'm addicted to anything that changes the way that I feel. I mean, I can be addicted to anything that changes the way I feel. In a good way. And sometimes in a bad way. Adrenaline is a huge rush for me. And I don't know how many of you can relate to that. But we enjoy setting up situations in our lives from time to time where we will be required to stay on the adrenaline rush in order to manage. That was a real hallmark of my drinking and drugging career, was the adrenaline, the drama, the adrenaline, the drama. And then, of course, the inevitable down. And who doesn't love a good down? I mean, come on, you know, in bed, crying, dying, you know, wallowing, pitching a tent and that stuff. Got to stay here. Love it. How are you? Oh, man, I'm like, oh, I'm just really struggling, you know. Bad news, some of us don't care. It's true. I had a sponsee that called me today. Who said, you know, I was going to be at your chair, but, you know, what the truth is that I had made a commitment to something else. And this is like a 5-minute message. Now, I want to be honest with you. I don't always listen to all your messages. I try to get the gist of it. And then I'm cutting you off. You know, it's push 9. I'm done. I called her back. I thought about it for a little bit. I thought, am I going to let this go? But I felt real tweaked there. So I called back and I said, hi, so-and-so, this is me. Got your message. Get that you're not coming to the meeting. Don't care. Thanks anyway. See you next time. No big deal. Love ya. How simple is that? How simple is that? You know, we love to complicate stuff. We love to complicate stuff. And the more excuses and explaining and layering a bull we can lay down, the more we will. Right? Am I right? Well, I couldn't because this happened and that happened and the other thing happened and then I was supposed to be across the street and then my windshield broke and the car died and you know what? I don't care. I don't care. You're not here. So what? It's a choice. Much of what we do is a choice. Stuff happens. Cars break down. Stuff like that. Okay. I get it. I don't care. Sorry. Glad you're here when you're here. When you're not here. Okay. You know, I so want to be taken care of. I so want you to take care of me and understand everything about me and why I do what I do and, you know, and get me. I want you to get me. Guess what? You don't get me. You know why? Because you're not me. And I'm not you. I know as much about you as I can. I love you. But I can't be you. I don't want to feel your feelings either. I don't. I have my own, thank you. Some of which are not all that great. Back to the story. I had to promise some people here tonight that I wouldn't be boring, so I better hurry up and get interesting. You know, I tried not to drink. At some point, I'm sure I tried not to drink and use the way that I did. Okay. I never tried not to drink. That would be a lie. Because I didn't see any reason not to. I have to tell you the truth. You know what? I didn't see any reason not to. I just didn't. Never did I connect my downward spiral in life. Downward spiral, I came from nowhere. It's not like I had anything to lose, okay? You know, I am truly a case of arrested development. You know, I stopped at 13. That's the truth. I did. When I showed up here is when I began to grow a little bit. So I showed up here at 13. You know, I tried stuff to get, like, to become a normal drinker. Like, I tried going and becoming a camp counselor. Can you believe somebody hired me to be a camp counselor? Is that just like, can you, I mean, honest to God. Now, this is a great story. This is how God works in our lives even when we're drinking. Okay? True story. I had finally decided to do something productive other than what I did all day, which was drink. And I had been a swimmer when I was a little kid. I was a pretty good little swimmer. And my mom and stepdad put me into a life-saving class so I could get a life-saving badge and maybe make a couple of bucks instead of stealing from them all the time. And mind you, it didn't stop me from stealing from them. But so I took this deal. Anyway, I ended up answering an ad in a paper during the summer. Now, I was not going to high school. I quit high school. I took a GED when I was at the long-term residential psychiatric hospital up in Maryland. And so I was done with that. There was, you know, I was done. And I passed, which was good. But I went and took this class, and so I got this, I answered this job ad. And it was an Episcopal church camp. And it was a great place. It was on the river in a place in Virginia that none of you would know, but it was rural, you know, cool place. And I liked the guy that was running the camp, he and his wife. And I don't know why he hired me. He said, I later found out, he said, I never before that summer and that one run of that ad have I ever advertised. Never had to. All the kids that ever come through this camp become camp counselors. We don't have to hire. And, of course, I'd lied and told him I had a water safety instructor certificate so I could get the job. And they hired me for that reason. But I remember using drugs. I remember using drugs and drinking, you know, while I was at that camp. And I got back after a summer of doing that, and I had to live with my mom. I had walked away from, I tried going to college too, which is pretty funny. Why do they put bars across the street from colleges? What is that about? I mean, how do they expect you to go to class? Honest to God. I mean, there ought to be a law. You know, that's just wrong. So I couldn't go to class. And you can certainly see why. Because they put those bars there. It is. It is not my fault. It was their fault. So I tried the college thing. That didn't work. So then I met this guy. I met him. And he was everything I ever wanted in a man. He was tall and dark and dangerous and so sick. So it was perfect. I mean, it was like the light shone from heaven. This is the one. Okay. And all the insanity in me hooked up with the insanity in him, and I was good to go. I'm good to go. Yes. This will fix me. This will fix me. I love him. Well, he was as misunderstood and underappreciated as I was. He was. He wanted to be an actor and, you know, wanted to live that lifestyle, and so did I. And, you know, it was just absolutely wonderful. And so we got pregnant. We were going to get married anyway. But then we sort of had to. And, you know, surely that was going to fix me. You know, being pregnant. You got to go. You got to be clean. You got to be straight. If you're an alcoholic of my type, being pregnant has nothing to do with getting sober. If you are an alcoholic of my type, there is a firm belief that somehow you get a pass. God's not looking. I'm going to drink and I'm going to use and the baby's going to be fine. See, I'm going to leave the baby over here. God got the baby. I'm over here. I'm drinking. I'm using. You're not paying attention. So I had this child, and he was fine. You know, he did not suffer fetal alcohol effect or fetal alcohol syndrome or whatever any of that stuff is. Don't ask me how. I had the baby, and having the baby didn't fix me. My drinking took off even more because, you know, what's worse than somebody who is afraid and angry and hates authority and doesn't like any have-tos? Give them a baby. That's a solution. Give them something to take care of. 24/7. There's a solution. So my drinking really took off. I remember leaving that baby, actually, and this is, again, recollections over the last few years. Front brain stuff. I'm sure it was in the back. But I remember leaving the baby to go to the 7-Eleven to buy the alcohol. Leave the baby in the house, shut the door, you know, quiet. Don't really want the neighbors to see, but, you know, I don't give a shit if they do. And go in the 7-Eleven and come back. Baby still here? Yep. Nothing's on fire. Good. Let's get loaded. Good. It's after 11 a.m. That's good. It works. So, you know, I had that baby. That didn't fix me. I was in a miserable marriage. Go figure. With Mr. Wonderful. And I got pregnant again. The night I did not want to have this baby, I scheduled a pregnancy termination. And the night before I was scheduled to go in, I went out with my husband, which I didn't typically do, and got really loaded, and I slept through the appointment. And his name is Matthew. He's 20, almost 21. This is the part that chokes me up. You know, that was a really defining moment for me. Not having that baby, not the fact that he came out. He looked like hell, I'll tell you that, when he came out. But he had no, you know, effect. He had no fetal alcohol effect. He had no fetal alcohol syndrome. Any of you who know Matthew may wonder about that, but... It's true, he's 100% healthy and 100% awesome, wonderful, loving, astounding young man. My mother had gone to treatment, finally. And she called me from the treatment center and said, I think you would like this place. And I said, I think not. I have this baby to nurse. Never mind, it's 90 proof. You know, I'm doing all this natural mother stuff. You know, I'm doing all this natural mother stuff. You know, I don't want to use drugs while I'm in the hospital having the baby, okay? But I'm going to drink as soon as I get out. I mean, you know, how insane is that? So, long and the short of it is, my mom came and got me the week she got out of treatment. How sick are Al-Anons? Really, you have to ask yourself. How sick is that? Came and picked me and my two sons up and brought us down to her house in North Carolina. I brought alcohol into her house every day in the desperate hope that she would drink. Because I knew that if she could get sober and Alcoholics Anonymous, that it could work for me. And I was terrified that there was a solution other than alcohol and drugs. Terrified that there was a solution other than alcohol and drugs to the problem that was me. I drank around the clock for 7 days and I could not get drunk. And I want to tell you, standing here today, the only reason I'm here today is because alcohol stopped working for me. I did not wake up one morning and say, oh, it's a great day. I'm really excited about this day. I think I'll get sober. I think I'll go to an AA meeting. Uh-uh. I came because alcohol stopped working for me. My mother called Alcoholics Anonymous because I stood in the doorway of her kitchen and I said, I can't do this anymore. And someone from Alcoholics Anonymous answered the phone because people take service positions, because people take and keep commitments in this program, the people who do. Keep it going. Someone answered the phone, and someone came and 12-stepped me, and the next morning someone came and took me to a meeting. That was April 21st of 1984, and I have not found it necessary to have a drink since. I have found it desirable to take a drink. I have found it seductive as heck to take a drink. I have found it... like a siren song. But I found Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I found Alcoholics Anonymous, I found you. And when I found you, I found what I've been looking for all this time. A place where I could be who I am. No matter what. No matter what. And you may not always like me, but you love me in that oh-so-special way. And I know that. I know that. And you know me at the level of heart. And that's what I needed. That's what I needed. I don't need you inside my skin. I don't need you inside my head. Most of the time, I don't want you there. I just want, when I pass you on the street or I sit down next to you at a meeting, I just want you to get, you know, to be with me and let's just be a part of together for a little bit. That's all I ever wanted. When I walked down the streets and I looked into those windows and I saw those people having their dinner, I wanted to be a part of that. I wanted to be a part of. I wanted to be cared for. I wanted to be cared about. And that's what you gave me. That's what you continue to give me. I want to tell you that I work the program of Alcoholics Anonymous as it's laid out in this book. I don't do any other program. I don't know about any other program. This is all I know. Okay? That's for me. You should also know that I grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous hardcore. Sit in the front of the meeting, keep your mouth shut. You don't talk when the speaker's talking. You don't get up and leave in the middle of the meeting. You do what you've been taught. And it's called, and I learned this, obedience to the unenforceable. Got it? I get that. Obedience to the unenforceable. I had absolutely no discipline when I came here. I didn't know how to clean a floor. I lived in a roach-infested apartment because I didn't care. I knew nothing about life skills, and I had two small children. I had no way to navigate in life without drugs and alcohol. And you gave me this book, and you said, here's what you do. You go to 90 meetings in 90 days. You get yourself a sponsor. Don't drink. Simple. Don't drink, and you can't get drunk. Change your playmates and your playgrounds. Ah, that's a big one for some of us, isn't it? Oh, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that. I had to do that. Didn't matter anyway. I'd already drank myself out of all my playmates and playgrounds. Nobody wanted to be with me anyway. That's the truth. You know, the solution for me is in this book. Again, I tell you, I work it as it's laid out in this book. That's it. That's all I know how to do. And I want to tell you, too, that when I first got here, there was, I don't know, I read this book for the first time and I said, oh, my God, there's people out there like me. And I know the language is old from the 1930s, and I know that it's written in a, you know, sort of that sort of male first person. But I don't care about that. I didn't care about it then, and I pray to God they never change it. I pray to God they don't ever feminize this or do some kind of bullshit to this. I don't want it. I just found out the other day, this is how behind I am, okay? I don't have a new edition big book. Bad me. I don't have one. Acceptance is not on page 449 anymore. What is that? I just got to tell you, I don't get that. I can't refer to page 449 anymore. Anyway. You know what? I am really radical about this stuff. I have a sponsor. I have been sponsored for these many years. I sponsor women. The women that I sponsor women. I find it's really important to do that. I mean, I don't know how to keep this without giving it away to you. I don't know how to keep learning unless you keep teaching me. Call me and ask me. Tell me what's going on for you. You know, let me hear that. Because I need to process that. I need to get it. You know, the book says that its main sole purpose is to help me find a power greater than myself. You know, there's no way around that. If you're not interested in finding a power greater than yourself, then I got to tell you, if that stuff scares you, alcohol and drugs will get you back in here if you're lucky enough to get back here. You know, we make no hard bargains about who your God is, what it looks like, he, she, it, they, them, whatever. Doesn't matter. But what I know is the only way I have a chance of staying sober is by the growth and maintenance of a spiritual life. I am selfish and self-centered in the extreme. That's what I know. Every day I have to watch for selfishness, self-pity, dishonesty, fear. These are the things that crop up that I will drink over. I will drink over those things. That's what I know is true for me today. You know, I love this. When we became alcoholics, crushed by a self-imposed crisis, we could not postpone or evade. We had to fearlessly face the proposition that either God is everything or else he is nothing. God either is or he isn't. What was our choice to be? And I got to tell you, for me, The key to staying sober today is to ask myself that question several times a day. Because, you know, I wanted to get back into the mainstream of life. I have done so. I am gainfully employed. I drive a car today. You know, I have a house. I live in a house. I own a house, sort of. In California, of all places. I mean, what an amazing freaking thing. I've moved in sobriety 4 times, I think. You know, just, and I'm talking states and across the country, let alone the little moves, you know, in between, in the same town. One of the things that has been really key to my sobriety is this. Being convinced we were at step 3, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to God as we understood Him. Just what do we mean by that, and just what do we do? What I love about this book is, Bill Wilson tells us what the problem is, and then he hands you the solution. It's in the book. It's all in the book. Now, if you're like me, you go back to this book and they've written stuff that wasn't there the day before. I don't get it. I read this pretty much every day. How do I stay sober today? I get up in the morning, for any of you who gives a rat's ass. I get up in the morning. I get on my knees. I literally roll out of my bed because my 8-year-old broke my bed recently, so it's actually on the floor. I roll onto the floor, which I have done for a number of years. And I say the 3rd-step prayer. I don't say the 7-step prayer. I don't say the 11-step prayer. I don't say the 4th-step prayer. I say the 3rd-step prayer. And then I go and I read some stuff that was written by people that are in a much, much better frame of mind than I typically am when I roll out of bed in the morning. And I try to put that in, and I spend a few minutes checking in. And I check in with the fact that I'm not in charge. That when I try to be in charge, things get really bad. And that I'm a mean, you know what? They used to call me a mean drunk. Well, I'm a mean sober drunk, too, without this program. The first requirement is we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. On that basis, we're almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. Even though our motives are good. Hey, I'm nice. I'm kind. I'm good. I've been sober for a long time. Guess what? That don't matter, because sometimes I want what I want when I want it, and I can't even see that. That's how fast it happens. The default position for me is selfish, self-seeking. That's me. That's my default without these steps, without you people in these meetings. So in order for me to stay on a spiritual basis, I have to do these things. And I find the longer I stay sober, the more important it is for me to do these things. I can't stray from this deal. I'm scared. I don't know about you. I have a disease that wants to kill me. It doesn't want to just get me a DUI. It wants to kill me. It doesn't want to just take my children or my house or my car. It wants to kill me and make me look like an idiot while it's doing it. And God knows I don't want that. I'd rather just die. Wouldn't you? Yeah. There is a message of hope in these rooms. If you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're like me, you don't believe I ever had a problem with alcohol if I've stayed sober 20 years. I didn't believe any of you. You got up and picked up chips for a year and 2 years, and I thought, well, shit, they don't have a problem. Right? I mean it. I could not comprehend. I hope that tonight you understand. There is hope and there is help in the program of AA if you keep coming back. Thank you all so much.